Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thank you for listening in. I am your host for today, Susan Franzen. As usual, we have a real spectrum of guests and topics for you today, starting with a report on Monday's multi-car pileup on I-35 near Ames. As many as 70 cars collided on the snow-covered freeway, killing Dana Esther, 53, of Independence, Missouri. Officials with Story County Sheriff's Department said the crash is the worst they've ever seen. We are fortunate to have with us as our guest Story County Emergency Coordinator Keith Morgan to give us an inside view of the scene. Thanks for being with us today, Keith.
Good morning.
So who was managing the scene on Monday?
Well, this was started off somewhat typical for what we do when we have any sort of an accident or an incident start. It starts off with the people that are in charge, the ones that have the jurisdictional authority for it. In this case, it was Story County Sheriff's deputies that were the first on scene, even though it's an Iowa State Patrol jurisdiction. They share duties there because just who is ever closest gets to the scene first. And we started actually monitoring the overall situation when we got the weather forecast that we were going to have some pretty heavy snow coming in. So we were watching it. We saw the roads rapidly deteriorate, and we started hearing on the radios the law enforcement starting to respond to it, and then it rapidly escalated from there to a fairly multifaceted kind of event where we had to shelter people. There was the medical response that was included. There was the law enforcement trying to prevent further accidents. We worked closely with the Traffic Incident Management Center for the Iowa DOT. And after that, it expanded on out where we were fortunate that we had resources from Ames available to help us out, the Sci-Ride, and they opened up their city hall for us to use as a sheltering center. So an event that starts with one car accident got pretty large pretty quickly.
Well, I first became aware of this when I saw the video that was, I presume that was a drone that took that. It was from the air, and you see cars speeding down. I mean, really driving way too fast on the highway and crashing into other cars. You keep saying we. Where and how did emergency management get involved?
Well, my office, emergency management, was, like I said, monitoring it on the radios. And Story County Emergency Management was requested by the Sheriff's Office through the dispatch agency to help out and assist with the collection of those that needed sheltering. And then we started to coordinate, again, reaching across over to the city of Ames to line up resources for that. So that's the way that it works. And emergency management is designed to come in when one jurisdiction doesn't have the resources to be able to handle the situation itself. We may provide resources to that particular person that's in charge, as we call them, the incident commander, or we may take over a small section of the response like we did here with sheltering.
Now, who was sheltered?
We had 33 people whose cars were disabled, and even after they got the road clear, it was obvious that they weren't going to be able to drive away from the scene. So we collected them up on Sci-Ride buses and then took them over to the Ames City Hall. And we had a Red Cross volunteer respond to the City Hall. And he went through and talked to each of the people to see what their needs were and to see if they had the capabilities to take care of themselves. And in this case, all 33 people had the capability to either get a rental car or pay for a hotel room. So after that, we worked with the City of Ames Recreation to provide them transportation either to the rental car place or to their hotels.
Well, one of the questions that we had when we saw this video was we saw people walking away from the accident. If you're in a pileup like that, and you can see, you know, people are coming up from behind you, speeding much too fast, and you've managed to not crash into anything in front of you. What's the best thing to do?
It really does depend on each situation, but if you're at the trailing end of the accident with more cars coming in, then it's probably a pretty good idea, if you can't get completely off of the road, to get out of your vehicle and get as far away from the road as you possibly can until things settle down, and then you might go back and shelter in your vehicle. But in those initial moments afterwards, it's really a judgment call, but oftentimes, if you see a lot of cars still coming in and piling in, it would probably be good to get out of your vehicle and get behind something that's going to provide you protection. If there are barriers or just distance between you and the roadway, because you could see in some of those videos, many of the vehicles that did try and veer away from the road went a considerable distance into the ditch. So just standing alongside the road may not provide you the protection you need.
No, that's right. Are there any precautions people can take to avoid being part of such a pileup?
First thing is to try and slow down and give yourself some distance from the car ahead of you. And another thing is to look way ahead of you as you're driving. Visibility was fairly reduced, but if you can look out as far as you can, and if you start seeing brake lights ahead of you, then start slowing down even further out. Tap your brakes, or maybe even put on your hazard lights if you know you're going to be slowing down significantly, to catch the attention of those people that are behind you so that they can start slowing down. This was that area is a difficult area because you're just coming on up over the overpass, over the railroad tracks, and it did provide limited visibility to see this kind of an accident ahead of them.
How did they decide and indicate that people should divert away from that section of 35? I know people who got stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic on E-29. Going into Ames, is that right?
Yes, and a lot of that was made real time. The law enforcement that was on scene at first were starting to divert people onto 13th Street at the 213 exit, or the 113 exit, but it rapidly, the accident extended on up to that point, so then they needed to extend that diversion even further. Iowa DOT is working on a plan to have these detours pre-identified and some resources identified to go up there, such as signage. But this accident was one of the fastest I've ever seen when it comes to how quickly it developed.
Thank you for coming in today to, or coming on by phone to be with us today to update us on what happened. Thanks a lot, Keith.
No problem. Stay safe out there.
The interstate remained closed Monday afternoon between 13th Street and U.S. 30 in Ames near mile marker 116, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. It was the largest crash in the state Monday, said Sergeant Nathan Ludwig, a spokesperson for the Iowa State Patrol. There were also fatal accidents in Decorah, Cedar Rapids, Cedar County, and Grinnell, with 7 people killed altogether. A tour bus transporting cast and crew of Dancing with the Stars Live, Light Up the Night, was involved in the crash on Interstate 80, presumably due to hazardous conditions after the snow fell over much of the state. The bus was en route to Stevens Auditorium in Ames. All the cast and crew members were fine, with some recovering from minor injuries. However, as anyone who had tickets for Monday evening knows, the performance was canceled. Thank you for being with us, Keith.
No problem.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've just been talking to Keith Morgan, Story County Emergency Coordinator, about the traffic emergency during the snowstorm on Monday. In spite of the turmoil of the day, the political party caucuses were held on Monday evening as planned. We're fortunate to have with us the same guests who introduced us to the caucuses last Friday. They're here again with us to give us a report about what happened at the Republican and Democratic caucuses. In addition, we'll have a report from the Libertarian Party, which achieved major party status on March 1st, 2017. First, Let's hear from Micah Hake, Publicity Chairman for Story County Republicans. Hi, Micah.
Yeah.
Thank you for being with us today. What was the turnout like at your Republican caucuses on Monday?
Well, as is not too surprising due to the weather, turnout was pretty low. But so it was good news to not hear that anybody had any accidents or trouble getting to and from. It was late enough in the evening that the snow had pretty much stopped by that point.
And the roads were pretty clear.
Yep, city workers cleared the roads pretty well.
What was the main business at the caucus?
The main business items for the Republican Party caucuses included nominating and electing individuals from each precinct to become Story County Republican Party committee members. And those people will have the opportunity to go on and volunteer for the local party and help organize events. And there's monthly meetings with those. And other business included electing delegates to attend the county convention. Beyond that, other business was to discuss and vote on party planks.
Do you have any sense yet what those were?
So the as attendance was low, there wasn't a lot of party planks that were proposed. I think through the county as a whole, we might have had about 40 to 50 of them. Just from a quick glance at the piles, we were kind of organizing all the information and inputs last night. And that, as that was just one small part of the business, and I didn't look at closely at the planks themselves, but I would assume that they're pretty relevant to current issues as well as common standard issues that the Republican Party is concerned about.
You mentioned to me earlier about the petitions, that there were petitions passed at the caucuses.
That's correct. Yeah. So candidates that are desiring to run for election have to gain enough support to even be considered to be put on the ballot for election. And this is a great opportunity with people gathering for the caucuses for potential candidates to spread their petitions, which is essentially they're gaining signatures, verifiable signatures from individuals. And there's certain thresholds that they have to meet based on what office that they would like to run for. So as you can imagine, county office runners only have to get a small number of signatures compared to individuals running for U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate.
So you had, I presume, mostly the state candidates and the county candidates rather than your national candidates. Not the national, obviously. This is a midterm election, but say you probably, since you've got incumbents in many of those major positions, you probably didn't have a lot of action there.
Yeah, so with the Republican Party caucuses, there's no big decision-making, or you don't have to differentiate which candidate you would like to prefer. And so just off the top of my head, I think there was maybe three petitions once everything was gathered up, three separate individuals asking for people's signatures for a House of Representatives post. And then the Secretary of Agriculture position, I think there was two individuals that were gathering signatures for that. And local county officials, I don't think there was any kind of, so to speak, challengers to positions. There was there were individual people looking for the signatures for those.
Thank you very much. That's a pretty complete report. And if there are any further developments, why, I hope you'll let us know.
Well, thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Micah. And now we'll turn to Louis Rosser, who was the Democratic chair of the caucus training committee. So he was in charge of making sure that the people who are running the caucuses in each precinct knew what they were doing. And actually, I think that is – The Democratic process is a little more chaotic, potentially, than the Republican. So I hope that we can get hold of Lewis soon to tell us about it. And I'm sure they had the same issue with the numbers being down a little bit. But since they had some candidates who'd been calling people to try to get them there, I think they may have had is Lewis on? No, excuse me. Okay, let me just talk a little bit more then about the Democratic caucuses, because one of the things they have that the Republicans don't have is the way they choose candidates is through preference groups. And so someone can say, I want us to divide into preference groups, and then they have to allow them to say, all right, who wants to be in a preference group for this candidate or that candidate? And so the candidates, this is a pretty crowded field for governor. And incidentally, if you've seen the Des Moines Register this morning, they already have their straw poll on how they all match up with Kim Reynolds. Okay. Lewis, are you there?
I am here.
Good morning, Susan. Okay. Well, thank you for being back with us again. Did you have a pretty good turnout?
We did, considering the weather, of course. We had about 600 folks brave the weather and get out and get to their caucus locations.
Here in Story County?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when they got there, did most of them break out into preference groups?
Well, it was interesting the way it broke out. The precincts that broke out in preference groups were predominantly in the city of Ames. But the precincts outside of the city of Ames throughout the remainder part of the county, they tended to just elect their delegates without breaking into preference groups.
I think that a lot of Democrats in Ames were getting phone calls from various candidates.
Yes, they were.
So did you have any sense who was being selected in those preference groups?
I have exact sense. We were able to tabulate those yesterday. And overall, throughout the county, actually, the uncommitted category had the most, with 82 delegates selected to the county convention as uncommitted. The next committed group of delegates was for Kathy Glosson. She had 50. Then comes down to Fred Hubble had 21. Nate Bolton had 20. John Norris had 10, and our own hometown candidate, Ross Wilbur Byrne, had 2.
So we had a real spectrum there.
Yeah, real spread of support for various candidates, and, really, especially the big number being the uncommitted, clearly says that there were, a number of Democrats out that evening that haven't decided who they're supporting, or in that group of uncommitted delegates, they were supporting someone else.
Well, there's also quite a spectrum. I mean, there are a few, like I think 4 candidates for the 4th district. Was there any attempt to get preference groups for them?
No, we did not hear that at all from any of the precincts. They all divided by gubernatorial preference.
You also had planks for the platform and the resolutions. Certainly, I know in national elections that is very active. How was it for this caucus?
There are 43 precincts. We had dozens and dozens of various platform resolutions that were submitted to our resolutions committee. We haven't tabulated those yet. Our committee will be meeting this Saturday to start going through those and getting them ready for the county convention.
Then, I guess, is there any other business that we need to talk to you about?
Well, regarding that procedure, the committee with the platform resolutions, they will look at the various ones that were submitted from the precincts. They will kind of merge together ones that are similar and prepare then the proposed platform resolutions to be presented to the county convention to vote on. Those will then go on to the congressional district convention to be considered.
Okay. Well, yeah. If you have any more news, please let us know.
Okay.
Thanks
okay.
a lot.
Great. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Yes, you too, Lewis.
Bye-bye.
That was Lewis Rosser, who is the Democratic, the caucus chair in Story County. Now we're going to move on to a new party, new to us, new to the state. Well, not new to the state because they've been running candidates for several years. But thanks to the last presidential election, where their national candidate, Gary Johnson, won 3.82% of the vote in Iowa, which is twice the threshold needed. They are a official major party. That's major party status. And they are organizing all over the state. And James Schneider, who is their party chair for the state, is going to be here with us in a few minutes to talk to us about their first caucus. And it's pretty exciting for them, and I think pretty interesting for us to hear about, because this is something new for the country to have a new official party, and that they are very well organized. I mean, organizing. I've been online, and I've seen where their caucuses were, and I looked like all 99 counties had caucus locations, and they have people running for office already, and that they are mostly soliciting people to be running. And there's a lot of information about how you can run. And apropos the article this morning about matchups with Kim Reynolds, 22% of the people were still undecided. So, of course, that's, I think, where the Libertarians hope to pick up some supporters, and perhaps some people who will be committed to another party. Hi, James.
Hey, good morning, Susan.
Well, good morning to you. We've been trying to introduce the Libertarian Party. I'm so glad that you're here to do this officially. So you had your first caucus on Monday night, and so would you want to talk about those?
Oh, sure. Just like the Republicans and Democrats had just said, you know, we had to suffer through the weather, which really, you know, it hurt our numbers, but we still made history for the party. We had 25 counties participate and elect local level leadership, which was phenomenal for us. You know, we've had a lot of local level affiliates before, but, you know, we had never gotten up to 25 counties before. And we also did a straw poll for governor, and Jake Porter, who's running for governor, won that with about 65% of the vote.
So he did have some challengers, though.
Yes. Marco Battaglia is also running, and he got roughly 30% of the vote, and 5% were uncommitted.
So what about any of the other offices?
We only did a straw poll for governor at our caucus. We were primarily, you know, doing this as a party-building exercise to elect those local-level leaders. That's what took up most of the time. You know, because this is our first time through, we kind of had to explain a lot of the how Iowa law is organized with, you know, having precinct committee members and county committee members, and what those roles are in Iowa election law for special election purposes and nominating special conventions and stuff like that.
Well, I mistakenly announced while I was waiting to get connected with you that you had all 99 counties represented, but I think I got that impression from looking at your website, where I saw your each caucus location and what counties would be eligible. So I guess that if there were people in any of county who wanted to come to a caucus, they could have.
Right. Due to logistics and having available leaders, we did kind of regional hubs and grouped some counties together. And unfortunately, in some of the rural counties, people weren't able to attend their regional hub. You know, I was getting phone calls and emails all day from people saying, yeah, I have to drive 30 minutes to my caucus. I don't want to risk it on these icy roads.
Yeah, I imagine you were hurt more by the weather than either what do you call them, the traditional parties?
Yeah, that's a nice way to say it. Just teasing.
Maybe people would be interested in what some of your planks will be, some of the things you've been talking about as issues that the Libertarian Party is particularly concerned with.
Well, most libertarian philosophy, whether it's at the federal or state level, you know, it roots down into we believe that people own their own lives and they can live in any way they choose as long as it doesn't forcibly interfere with another person's equal right to live their life how they choose. So you can apply that same principle to just about any issue. And that's kind of the meat of what we stand for.
Well, I noticed you said something about human trafficking on your website.
Yes. You know, that is an issue that, a lot of people are in favor of. Marco Battaglia, that's one of his key issues that he's running on in opposition to that.
And how does that fit in with your libertarian philosophy?
As I had said, about interfering with, it's immoral to use force or coercion against somebody. So with human trafficking, you're violating somebody's individual right.
So
their freedom to choose.
So you're talking about force or coercion, not just by the government, but from other people.
Correct. And that's what government's role is. I mean, we're not pure anarchists that government's there to help protect citizens from force and fraud.
I think a lot of people don't understand that about libertarians. I think we don't quite have enough time to go into depth about the philosophy of the Libertarian Party, but I think it's very interesting to have you as part of the political mix, and thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Yes, thank you.
We'll hear from you again. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye. Thank you, Susan.
And thank you. That was James Schneider from the Libertarian Party that had their first caucuses as a major party with major party status last Monday. And we're going to now shift from the traditional politics to another quite important political issue. This is KHOI Community Radio, in case you just tuned in, and you've heard from officials from the three recognized political parties in Iowa, Republican Micah Haake, Democrat Louis Rosser, and Libertarian James Schneider.
I'm happy.
shifting to the politics of agriculture, we'll turn to the colloquium on the Farm Bill last Wednesday, hosted by the Iowa Farmers Union. It featured stories of beginning farmers and explanations of the bill by National Farmers Union President Roger Johnson. On our website, we have a well-produced video of the entire presentation with lots of charts and other visual aids, which are way beyond what we can share with you on the radio. Except, if you want to go to our website, you can click on the link and see it yourself. But to give us an orientation of the issues involved, we have George Naylor, farmer from Sherdan, who has years of experience lobbying on behalf of the National Family Farm Coalition. He's also on the board of the NGO Project and the Center for Food Safety, as well as being a member of the Iowa Farmers Union. Hello, George.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Susan.
Okay, what are the big issues you see the Farm Bill dealing with?
Well, first I'd like to say, even though I've been farming for over 40 years, I'm actually a new farmer myself. I've got my first organic soybean crop this last year. And anyway, I think for every farmer, when spring rolls around, they're a new farmer too, in a sense. And because growing things, putting seed in the ground, and finding out what's going to happen at the end of the year, hopefully something that's going to be good and something that you can sell for a profit, is thrilling every year. And so I would encourage any young person that's thinking about becoming a farmer to do everything they could. And, I think they should go around and ask people's opinions. If you ask for advice, people will want to want you to follow their advice. But and then if you don't, well, they're upset. But if you just ask for a bunch of opinions, then you can figure out your own way. So that's my bit of wisdom, I guess, from the first place. But it is very difficult for somebody to become a new farmer, I think. It takes capital. You have to have land. Ideally, a family farmer would own their own land, so they would be completely in charge, and they would be able to take care of that land based on the idea of what's good for the land and what's good for that land in the future, so that they could maybe pass it on to the next generation. And be a responsible citizen. But it's otherwise, if you're a renter, and I've had members of my family, both of my mom's family and my dad's family were farmers, and many of my aunts and uncles never did own land. They always rented, and I will guarantee you that that is not always a pleasant situation. They don't call landlords for nothing. Yeah, it takes capital, and luckily in my case, when I started farming 41 years ago, when I really actually wanted to be an organic farmer then, luckily the farm here was in the family, and everybody was thrilled that I would want to be a farmer, and so I had some family financial backing, and I'm really farming today only because of that. You got to think about which kind of farmer you're talking about too. There's so many young people now that would like to raise vegetables and fruit and sell to local markets. And even then, that's difficult. Even though it may not require so much land, it's difficult to have enough labor. And you got to have water sometimes. One of the big problems for any farmer. But especially if you're getting into a new type of production like fruit and vegetables for local demand, you have to know that there's going to be a market for what you're selling, and you have to estimate how much you can produce and what price you're going to get for it. Otherwise, you may find out in the first year that you're not economically viable right off the bat. So, that has to be taken into account. But otherwise, I would say the investment, the risk that you're going to take in becoming a new farmer is definitely worth it.
Well, yes. About the Farm Bill, one of the things that was stressed in the presentation that I saw and that you saw too, right? You got to see the...
Yes, uh-huh.
Was some devices for helping new farmers to get land, because there's going to be a huge turnover. Two things. First, there's going to be a huge turnover in land in the next very few years, certainly the next 5 years while this farm bill is in effect. And the other is that I'm not sure whether it was there that I learned that, but half of the farmers last year didn't make a profit. And this is all kinds of farmers. This is big farmers and small farmers. So what is the farm bill going to do to address those issues?
Well,
or could it?
I think probably there are quite a few little small programs that can help beginning farmers. It's difficult to say how much funding those will get and how many of those will get passed and whether they're actually, you know, the law is administered in a way that's really going to do the job. But the big problem, the biggest problem is when, like you say, half the farmers haven't made any money at all this year, is that when you leave farm policy so the only mechanism of determining prices is supply and demand, well, that's a disaster. And that's what we've had now for over 50 years. It's called market-oriented policy. Because how can anybody determine whether down the road here the supply and the demand is going to be at a price that's going to be able to keep farmers on the land? The fact of the matter is that big corporations are down in South America encouraging new production all the time. Using like Roundup Ready crops, and they sometimes are involved in big consortiums that'll bring in thousands or even millions of acres into production. So the world supply will keep growing and usually faster than what the demand is. So it's almost a guarantee that there's going to be long periods of time, especially for commodity crops, where the price of those products are below the cost of production for farmers here in the United States. And so what you end up with is, you know, we've had a boom in prices coinciding with the financial crisis, I might add, and that's not an accident, but that's something I would have to explain in a longer program. But so when you get a boom and bust economy, farmers haven't been making a buck for a long time, and then the boom comes. Well, people start borrowing money, land inflates, people go in debt, and now we go down to the opposite side of that boom into a bust, and farmers are going to go broke because the prices are so low that a lot of them can't pay for what they've bought on borrowed money. So you take that into account, and you take into account the problem of supply and demand, even on the local basis. You know, farmers' markets, you can get too many people selling one type of product, you know, too many tomatoes or too many this or that. And you've got always the phenomenon of somebody being so smart that they can figure out that there's economies of scale to do it one way or another, and you get in a bunch of hired labor to do the work, and you can oversupply the market. So really, until that is addressed, and what the way that I would address that on a national scale and a global scale is to have a program that aims for parity for farmers, and that there would be a social contract between farmers and the rest of society so that farmers could actually make a living without having to exploit their land. Right now, today, farmers are planting fence row. They feel like, man, I've got to produce every bushel I can because the price is so low, and down the road, every bushel I produce is going to help me stay on the land. But that's really a disaster when you look at Iowa, where all we're raising is corn and soybeans, and where our nutrients are going down the water down the rivers to the Gulf of Mexico. And livestock is being fed in great big feedlots or in hog confinements, for instance. So that's the supply and demand answer for agriculture is totally a disaster, and that's what really is the biggest obstacle for, I think, new farmers. And another thing to understand is because this is a global food market these days, and that market is being enforced on countries all around the world by the World Trade Organization. The intention of the World Trade Organization and these other free trade agreements was to take away every country's food sovereignty so that they're just sitting there having to let cheap imports come into their country, drive their farmers off the land. And consequently, they experience the same kind of farm consolidation that we've experienced here. And they end up producing things for export, and they have to then import much of the food that they do consume in those countries. We have a policy that's for the benefit of big corporations selling genetically modified crops, big machinery, and chemicals. We do not have a family farm policy in this country, and that's the biggest obstacle we have for a beginning farmer.
Thank you. I think this is a bigger issue than the farm bill. I don't know whether you can see any possible things that could go into the farm bill that would help, but we're sort of out of time, but I do recommend people who are interested in learning what is in the farm bill or could be in the farm bill going to our website and checking that out. And we have to have more conversations with you at another time, George. Thank you for coming in today.
Well, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll wrap up our programs today on a lighter note with previews of two plays in our listening area that are opening this weekend. We'll start in Boone and move to Ankeny. Here's Susan Herrick, director of Boone Community Theater's dinner theater production of Nonsense. Let's hear what she has to say. Why don't you tell us first when people can get tickets? Because I'm sure that's one of the questions that they will be thinking about.
And they're probably going to want to do that really fast. Our first weekend is already sold out. Our second weekend will be Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the 15th, 16th, and 17th of February, and those tickets are going fast. So we're having five dinner theaters. We have to have the dinner part reserved a week out.
So what's the deadline for getting a dinner theater ticket for next weekend?
Dinner theater ticket would have to be gotten by the 8th of February.
That's tomorrow.
That's tomorrow. But if we have sold all the dinner theater tickets and there are still extra tickets left over, then we will seat people in the general audience. It doesn't look like there's going to be much of that happening next weekend because, like I say, those tickets are flying out the door pretty fast. I just love this show. It is a musical comedy by Dan Gogan. It is the story of five nuns who are members of the Little Sisters of Hoboken, and they've had a terrible thing happen at the convent. Sister Julia, child of God, who is the cook, managed inadvertently to poison most of the nuns when she made vichyssoise soup, and so there are only 19 of them left, and five of them have undertaken to do a fundraiser to try and raise the money to bury the last four nuns, and that's what the musical is about. It takes place in the auditorium of the Mount St. Helen School on the set of the eighth grade production of Grease. So when the audience arrives, they will look at a set for the musical Grease, and then later, as the show starts, Mother Superior will explain to the audience that they have borrowed this set to try and raise money to bury those last four nuns. And there are five nuns in the cast, the Reverend Mother, of course, and she pretty much takes care of what happens on the stage. She's Mary Regina, and her sidekick is Sister Mary Hubert, who is the mistress of the novices. Then there's Sister Robert Ann, who is pretty much a streetwise character from Brooklyn, who ended up becoming a nun and doesn't regret it at all, but still has a pull to be a star on the stage. So you'll see a little of that. Sister Mary Leo, who is a novice, and she would like to be the first nun ballerina. And the final one is Sister Mary Amnesia, who has lost her memory when a crucifix fell on her head, and so she is this very sweet little vacant lady who doesn't really know who she is, but is quite delightful on the stage. And in fact, all five of these women are hysterically funny, and I'm lucky enough to have a cast of five women who can sing the socks off of each other. They are so good, and we're just having a ball with the music and the script. For the most part, it's great fun to watch them work together and figure out how they're going to get out of this little dilemma they've found themselves in.
As you heard Susan say at the beginning, this week is already sold out, and tomorrow, Thursday, February 8th, is the deadline for reserving dinner ticket reservations for next weekend, Thursday, February 15th, Friday, February 16th, or Saturday, February 17th. All dinners are at 6 p.m., with the play starting at 7 p.m. If you miss the deadline for dinner theater, you can still get tickets for general admission until those two are gone. You can get tickets at BooneCommunityTheater.org. Our website will also have the link. Finally, we're going down to Ankeny to talk to the director of their Valentine's Week play, actually 2 weeks, Almost Maine. Here's Barbara Wagner to give us a preview.
Well, we chose this to do around Valentine's Day. It is a story that has 9 vignettes. They all take place in a fictional town called Almost Maine. And they all technically take place at 9 o'clock on the same night, the Northern Lights are to appear in Almost Maine. And they are little subjects of love, love lost, love hurt, love won. And some of them are metaphorically speaking. And I know that the theater chose this to do around Valentine's Day just because it shows all aspects of relationships. And it's a good date show. And so we've had a lot of fun doing it. We rehearsed. Let me back up here just a second. The show was originally written for 4 people to play all parts in 9 vignettes. However, the author puts in the script that you have flexible casting, which allows, and for a community theater, this is great, for however many you want. So I decided, especially with winter rehearsals, to cast individual people for every role. So we have 19 in the cast, and I also was interested in possibly casting real-life couples. And that also helps come wintertime when you're trying to rehearse. And it's nice after the holidays, husbands and wives have some time to spend just the two of them. So I have 5 real-life married couples playing opposite each other. And then I have a dating couple and in real life. And then I have other veteran actors in the Des Moines area. And also we have 4 new people to Ankeny Community Theater. So we've got a well-rounded cast. We've had a great amount of fun putting it together because we rehearsed 1 vignette at a time. And then, I'd say maybe about 2 weeks ago, everybody got together and got to see each other's. So it was really fun. Now we're just one big cast. And all the people in Almost Maine know each other, so everybody's having fun getting to know each other and acting like we're really people in a town. So it's been a lot of fun. Like I said, I think there's probably at least one scene in the show that everybody's probably going to relate to. They've either gone through it in their life or know somebody who has. So it's kind of a blast down memory lane, and I joke about either we're going to have some marriages by the end of the show or babies or divorces. We open this Friday, February 9th. We run 2 weekends through the 18th. So it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then the next week is Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So it's a great Valentine's Day outing. However, Valentine's Day is on Wednesday, the 14th, but we do have a show the next night, and we are happening to do a Throwback Thursday on February 15th, where the price is a few dollars less than regular price. So we're doing that because we just added Thursdays for this season, starting this season anyway, and so we're trying to do some fun things to try to get people to come on Thursday night.
Although it wasn't mentioned, there the website shows there are also Sunday matinees at 2 p.m. both weekends. The easiest way to get tickets is to go to their website, AnconyCommunityTheater.com. And by the way, both of these, theater is spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E, theater. So go to their website, AnconyCommunityTheater.com, and click on the poster for Almost Maine, and then you'll see their ticket sale icon, and you can go on and buy tickets. You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Susan Franzen. Thank you for listening. Other voices you heard were Keith Morgan, Micah Hake, Louis Rosser, James Schneider, George Naylor, Susan Herrick, and Barbara Wagner. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI 89.1 FM. Remember that you can also hear us online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So, if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Iphigenia, a new telling of an old legend about the daughter of Agamemnon, February 23rd through March 4th in Ames. Tickets and show times at theater.iastate.edu.